F4.
Number 3, B.
It is interesting to look back into the history of the development of the idea. You have felt up to now and from other summer school that I'm very hot always on the history of idea. Because, you know, Mrs. Eddy, when she was once asked if she could name a good practitioner, she said, no, I can't name it, but take one who knows Christian Science history. Because when one knows Christian Science history, and that doesn't mean what bonnet Mrs. Eddy was wearing and if she was fond of ice cream and things like that, but when are considering the history of the idea, how the idea developed and unfolded, then it's always good, because this unfoldment of an idea is something that applies to all of us, that has applied to the Old Testament, that has applied to the New Testament, that applied to Mrs. Eddy, that applied to John Dolley, that applies to us. We unfold in a scientific way, not in a haphazard way, not in a just an inspirational way, but in a scientific, divinely outlined way. The chain of scientific being reappearing in all ages. So here at this point it is interesting that for a long time John Dolley was mostly contemplating the level of Christian Science in his practice, which he had a big practice. Then little by little, so as far as I could see it, accent changed at the end of the 30s to see there is the level of absolute Christian Science and then to the level of divine science, because he began to see that in the book of Revelation and then in the chapter on Apocalypse. And only in 1949, you see, at the same time when he wrote me that letter which I quoted to you, it was around about that same time that something else broke into his thought. At that time, up to that time, he was here and there in his verbatim reports talking about the level of Christian Science and then absolute Christian Science and divine science. And then in spring 1949, he suddenly said, and finally we see that there is still a level higher than that. And he called it science itself. Science itself. So that was, so to say, the climax of his life work, 49, with the summer schools in 49 on the four Gospels, where he was showing the interlocking of these levels with as laws of interdependence. So we have here the third category, and you can easily see how they represent always higher levels of spiritual thought. They are all spiritual, but they are higher levels within the spiritual, so that, to repeat again quickly, in Christian Science, we begin to see how spirit is dominating the flesh, truth over error, mind over matter, you know. Then, once we have dropped the sense that we have always to correct things, that the science is here to bring forth new computation, new calculus, we touch the absolute sense of Christian Science, where we reason in life, truth, and love, as a trinity, so to say, as three tones in one, not as a sequence from life to truth to love, but three together, as a triad, so to say. What do you say in music? Chord? Yeah. Whatever it is, you know it, huh? Yeah, wonderful. I wonder why I should teach anything, you know it already. And then he began to see, well, in actual being, there is not constant new computation going on and on and on. it's all already included in the infinite one. So that principle includes the idea. The principle and idea is one. That being includes all the possible computations that are possible, and we have to see it all already, the oneness of being. That's divine science. Finally saying, why should I constantly contemplate principle and idea is one, which Mrs. Eddy said, which is called, that this one is God, fine, full stop, God, just the being, just the one being. And so he saw, well, actually, there is a level above that, that is science itself, where we only contemplate, really, how each capitalized term is conscious of itself, of its wholeness, where principle is only conscious of its own principle, of itself as principle. So you can elaborate that and see, well, mind is its own infinite mind. That's all what's going on. That mind is its own infinite spirit. That mind is its own infinite soul. So you can go through the 7x7 again, elaborating just always that altitude of thought where you say, well, being is just its own being. And being is conscious of what? Being is not conscious of people, he's not conscious of an age, he's not conscious of a universe, he's not conscious of a nation, he's not consciousness of a family, not consciousness of a business, he's not even conscious of sin, sickness and death, it's just conscious of itself. And this naturally is a terrific altitude of consciousness, which when we touch it, naturally, is the answer to everything. It doesn't leave out the healing. Not at all. Because if mind is conscious of itself just as mind, then it's not conscious of any mortal mind. The mortal mind is the basis of all sickness. So in this way, John Dolly showed us really the spiraling up of our understanding to the point of where we just see there is one being. Yes. So we have those three categories, and you know that we can put those three categories of capitalized terms just into one model, to one model of being. That is what you have on page 4 of your illustrative material. There on the top, can you see it on the top? It's the model of being, figure 1, and you know that model of being very well from the earlier summer schools. And what it shows, just to recapitulate it, is that it combines and reflects just those three categories. There is nothing in that model of being except the 7 synonymous terms, the 4-fold operation of the Holy City as Word, Christ, Christianity and Science, and the 3rd category, on the left-hand side, the 4 levels of science. So if we have those 3 main categories and blend them into each other, we have that fundamental model of being. And it is something that is fundamental to our teaching. Here you see very clearly on the when you start on the lower level of Christian Science, then we need all the 7 synonymous terms in order to define, really, the level of absolute Christian Science from the point of view of the Word and of point of view of the Christ, which is the Christ order, from the point of view of Christianity, the 7, this Christianity order, and then the 4th aspect, Science, you have again the 7 synonymous terms as the candlestick. What you have there is a stylized candlestick? Can you call it the candlestick styled? Yeah? Or stylized? Yeah? Okay. So you have this, again, there, the science order. But when we have said we rise higher and have seen mind, spirit, soul, that does away with the fundamental error of mortal mind, matter, and the sense testimony, we can drop those three synonymous terms and have, on the higher level of absolute Christian science, just the demonstration of that divine principle as life, truth, and love, the positive demonstration. Positive demonstration of the principle is that it demonstrates life, truth, and love. And so you have absolute Christian science with these three synonymous terms. On the level of divine science, it is even more reduced, and you only have one synonymous term there to define the word, because we are in the oneness of being, and so you have the word as life, the Christ as truth, the one truth, I must say, Christianity as the one love, and then science as the divine principle love. Well, this is all in my book on the four-level book, and therefore I don't have to explain anything there in that level book, which I think is a classic. You have explained the whole model of being. In that model of being, we must perhaps remember one thing, namely that these levels of science are not levels that are on top of each other. We have to draw it on a two-dimensional paper, so that it more or less represents that model of being. But they are not really on top of each other. What is called in other science a control hierarchy, where the upper level controls the lower levels. But it is what is called a nested hierarchy, where every level is nested in the other levels. It's like box within boxes, perhaps we can say. And so we must not consider them as four drawers in your chest of drawers, one on top of each other, but blended into each other, which means that they have relationship, that they are not separated, one level from the other, but that they are interrelated. And we call that interrelationship also the laws of interdependence. Interdependence, they depend on each other. Huh? Inter means correspondingly one. How can you say that? They are interchanging, interrelated, so to say. And so they are always operating, so to say, at once. Now, what John Dolly has seen as a climax of his teaching in the Oxford Summer School 1949, in those two volumes which he published afterwards on the four Gospels, he showed, for instance, you see, the interrelationship of absolute Christian science with the level of Christian science. He took those two levels and showed how they operate together, how they are interrelated with each other. And so he showed that Matthew knew all about it, that it isn't something new, that it's not an invention of John Dolly, that Matthew knew it. So Matthew shows that interdependence of life, truth, and love, see, in absolute Christian science, with the word order in Christian science as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love. Which means that he shows how life, truth, and love is the impelling power that brings forth mind. That life, truth, and love is the impelling power that brings forth spirit. That life, truth, and love is the impelling power that brought forth soul. The three temptations. That mind, spirit, soul is impelling power behind principle, behind the teaching of principle, Sermon on the Mount. that life, truth, and love is the impelling power behind life, bringing forth life. One healing after the other is shown there. That life, truth, and love is the impelling power for truth. And he shows the manhood of truth, the wholeness of truth, the form of man, the consciousness of man. That life, truth, and love is the impelling power of love. Actually, it had to do all with the crucifixion and the resurrection. So, if you read Matthew, you see, actually, this interrelationship here between absolute Christian science and Christian science. The same he shows with Mark, namely the interrelationship of the Christ as truth, life, and love interrelated with the Christ order. Then again, he shows Luke as the law of interrelationship or interdependence of absolute Christian science of life and love with the Christianity order. And John, our subject, will show us the interrelationship which exists between truth and love in absolute Christian science, interrelated with the candlestick order, the science order, as you have it here. So, can you see what we will do with the Gospel of John? We'll contemplate really only a part of that whole model of being. The Gospel of John doesn't show the whole science of being. He only shows one aspect, but a very important aspect. There on the last vertical, he shows truth and love in absolute Christian science, how that impels, really, and brings forth the science order, the candlestick order. We'll come back to it when we go further on. Yes. So, this is what we will see in John. And having done that, I think I have really presented, so to say, the fundamentals that are necessary in order to understand now Jesus' life seen from the standpoint of John. And so I go further to have a look at the four Gospels. So you see the four Gospels, as I have shortly indicated, are actually showing one figure, Jesus. There are four stories, four presentations. They are different from each other. Why are they different? Because each gospel writer writes from another standpoint. He looks at the holy city. He looks at Jesus, who represented the holy city. He looks at Jesus, Matthew, from the point of view of the Word. Then Mark looks at it from the point of view of the Christ. Then Luke from the point of view of Christianity. And John from the point of view of science. So it is all about the same figure, about Jesus. Who was Jesus? Well, we don't want to make a long story about Jesus, but fundamentally for our subject we have to know that Jesus was not an academically trained and educated man. He was a man of the street. As far as we know, he was not theologically educated like the Pharisees were, like the scribes were, like the whole theological hierarchy was. He was not a Pharisee, he was not a scribe, he was a common man, the man of the street, he was a layman. And I want to stress that because I want to show that we need something else as our education than the theological education, the ordinary academical education. That Jesus had quite a different education, very much different than the theological hierarchy. And it is interesting to see that the big thinkers were usually not very well educated people, that they had usually an average education. Think of Mrs. Eddy. She only went to school for a few years. She didn't go to college and high school or what you have in the universities and made a PhD and a doctor and so on. She was educated more or less at home by her brother, who was a big guy. I quite agree, and she got certainly a good insight into the most fundamental thing. But she didn't have a high education. Nor did John Dolly. He had just an average education, not a very good one, not a university education, not a high college education, nothing like that. And he was one of the best thinkers of our age, if not the best, after Mrs. Eddy. So, in order to get an education, a right education, we have to go to principle as our teacher and let ourselves be taught by the divine principle and deduce everything from the divine principle, never deviate in the deduction from that divine principle and reason along the categories of the divine principle. Then we get a very good education, an education which is destined for everlasting life. And that's the main point. This was called the Christ. But not always the Christ. He had different names for his job that he had to accomplish here on earth. The Jewish expectancy was always that there would be a Messiah coming. The Old Testament was always asking and hoping for Messiah. So he was called Messiah must come. Whereas the Greek-speaking people were calling it Christos, the Christ. Christ is a Greek terminology for the Messiah. And the Hellenic Greek, those in Greece, they were calling it the Son of God. So it's a Messiah, or it's a Christ, or it's a Son of God. They called, the Greek naturally called him the Son of God because that was adapted to their theological concept, because they had a mystical or a mythological concept of religion. They had a whole pantheon of gods, as you know. They had a god that was mother and a god that was father, and if father and mother got together, those two gods, they usually got the son, a child, that was also a god. So it was the Son of God for the Greek. So the Son of God and the Christ, according to who wrote the Gospels, they would use the one or the other expression. We must remember that in that country where Jesus was, many languages were spoken. The household language was Aramaic. Huh? Then they knew Hebrew language. But there were a lot of Greeks in Palestine, so Greek was spoken also as a second or third language. So we have quite a mixture of language in the texts of the Bible. We have four Gospels, and we usually make a distinction between the first three Gospels and the fourth Gospel. The first three Gospels are usually called the Synoptics, the Synoptic Gospels. Synoptics is from two Greek words, syn and optics. You know, syn is always together, means together. And optics, you know from the optician, to see. So it means see together. It can be seen together. Meaning that Matthew, Mark, and Luke more or less, tell a story that is parallel to each other. Therefore, very often there are publishers who publish the synoptics side by side, so that you have on two pages side by side, you have first the text of Matthew on a certain subject, and the same text from Mark on that very subject, and from Luke the text from that very subject, so that it can be seen together, and you can easily compare how Matthew looked at a certain situation and how Mark looked at it and how looked at it. But John is not on it. John is so different that he is so fundamentally different that he cannot be compared with the synoptics. And that makes him unique. And that uniqueness is naturally what we want to bring out. Perhaps just a last remark on those four Gospels, which give us an indication of the message of John. The Gospels were written, the synoptics were written rather early. The people that should know about it, the specialists, they don't know exactly. They always end up and say, we don't know when it was written, but it was written around about. So I can tell you the roundabout. So the synoptics, like Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were written round about between 50 and 60 A.D., which means Jesus was crucified in round about 30, 32, one doesn't quite know. So these synoptics were written round about 20, 30 years later. And they were writing about him, the way they have witnessed him, the way they lived with Jesus and have seen his life story and what he went through and so on. Whereas John, he wrote very late. He wrote about 30 years later. Again, the date is not clear, but most agree somehow that the revelation of St. John was written around about 95. The Gospel was written later than the revelation, namely around about the turn of the century, together with the three epistles of John. So the last written text of the Bible was the Gospel of John and his letters that were accompanying the Gospel of John when he sent the Gospel of John to the various churches. So this is very important. Why is it important? I tell you this afternoon.